Just to give you an overview of what I'm going to be addressing is dealing with first on a global perspective and then narrowing it down to this perspective of for the national perspective on the issue of the church in the public square. Just on the global perspective, a few items to address briefly. We know that back in 1995, two specific events had taken place that involved religious nationalists in Hamas. In Israel, they had assassinated Yitzhak Rabin. And also in Japan, the cultic group Aum Shinriko ended up releasing a gas in the subway that resulted in 12 deaths and thousands that were injured. And also here in the national perspective here in America, Christian militia groups were associated with Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols in the bombing of the Murrah Federal Building. Mark Juergensmeyer approaches this issue from a sociological perspective, and basically he identifies these three groups as well as others that have one theme in common. He identifies them as religious nationalists, as those groups that have fundamentalist religious convictions and seek to mold societal values by them. Religious nationalists, they sense a lack of social stability in liberal democratic societies, and they also believe that religion is the solution to bring back stability and basically long-lasting support for society. In America, Mark Juergensmeyer has identified Jerry Falwell and formerly Ralph Reed of the Christian Coalition as being individuals that would be identified as religious nationalists. Now, the challenge that we face here in America is that the more zealous religious nationalists become, the more in opposition secularist groups. There's a conflict going on between these groups here in America. And I term it, based on the dialogue that's going on in American society today, I term that the secular sacred war of the 21st century. And these are just a few of the remarks that were made by Melvin Lipman. He's the president of the American Humanist Association. He states that Timothy LaHaye, the Christian fundamentalist author of the Left Behind series, was on the Jerry Falwell show about 6 months ago, and he said, "We're in a religious war and we need to aggressively oppose secular humanism. These people are as religiously motivated as we are, and they are filled with the devil." Karl Rove, Bush's chief political strategist at a meeting of the Theocratic Family Research Council in March of this year, spoke about the war on secular society. And he said, "We need to find ways to win the war. And so, as Lipman says, it's a war against us and we need to fight back in this war." In 2003, speaking to the Christian Coalition, Alabama Governor Bob Riley spoke about a more important war than the war in Iraq. He said the war against secular humanists is a war for the absolute soul of this country. He called for a crusade to restore the Christian character of America. And this individual, Melvin Lipman, concluded his presentation by stating, "Well, friends, I think we should be prepared for a crusade. It's creeping up slowly. Changes are not made all at once. We're not going to have a government that takes away our rights not to believe all at once. But we've got to see the signs. We've got to see what is happening. And we have to be prepared to defend ourselves." So statements like this, in essence, what they do, such rhetoric on both secular and religious sides can hardly be salutary for societal cohesion and much less so to facilitate meaningful dialogue that seeks for common ground between liberals and conservative religious groups. Senator Barack Obama made this statement that I felt was worthy of inclusion here because he seeks for that common ground. He suggests that democracy demands that religious Americans translate their concerns into universal values and that secularists make room for faith and morality in the public square. Now, again, this is dealing specifically with the American setting here in America with the democracy that we have. Based on his statement about common ground, I'm approaching the topic of social justice and also natural law theory, and establishing the parameters of both of those. Social justice, by definition, social implies society. Justice comes from the Latin term justitia, and the term jus, J-U-S, actually is also translated in Latin as jus, and it means law, and then itia is translated as the I-C-E ending of justice. So putting those two together, social justice is actually a just ordering of society, or an ordering of society according to law. societal institutions. It involves such concepts as law, politics, and societal institutions, such as churches, synagogues, and mosques, and the people who comprise them. Thus, a just ordering of society, or an ordering of society according to law, is based on that definition. Social justice and natural law intersect. At this intersection lies the structure for a just ordering of society. Social justice includes such things as abortion, euthanasia, biogenetics, dignity of the human person, racial equality, labor rights, etc. Natural law speaks to each of these issues. Now, I'm not going to take time to develop each of those through this presentation. Obviously, there's not enough time for that. But at the end of the presentation, I'm going to come back to one currently debated hot issue here in America, which is dealing with same-sex marriage from the perspective of natural law. Moving into the evolution of natural law, there's actually three distinct stages in the history of natural law during the last 2,500 years. The first stage was classical natural law theory, which was advocated and actually written about and discussed and debated among Greek philosophers. It dates as far back as the 300 BC with Sophocles in the writings that he'd done about it. There was actually a lady that, by the name of Antigone, that appealed to higher law as a reason for not obeying the law that had been commanded by the ruler at that time. The next stage of natural law theory, there was an evolution between the classical stage and what was advocated and actually developed by St. Thomas Aquinas of the Catholic Church. By 533 AD is when Justinian incorporated the various laws of the Roman society and Greek society, formulating the Code of Justinian. Interestingly, Isaac Husik, an individual that did this study on that time period, notes that the original formulation of Justinian's code of law, it did not include a Christian element. And for that reason, natural law theory from a classical perspective basically was in conflict with a Christian perspective of natural law theory. And it was Augustine that took the two that were at dissonance and united them together in what is understood to be the Catholic tradition of natural law theory. He grounded it in God's eternal law, and he also viewed natural law as the means for man's moral perfection. Therefore, it related to the aspect of society. One other point on Catholic natural law that is significant to church-state relations and the church in the public square. According to Catholic natural law theory, natural law is something that is applicable to all citizens, regardless of whether they are believers or not. Thus, the political order from the Catholic perspective of natural law theory is that you've got God, next you have the church, and then you have the state, and then the individual. Based on this perspective, you see that the individual is subject to the moral theology of the Catholic Church as it is enforced and advocated through the level of the state. Protestant natural law theory, which is the third phase of it, in response to the development of Catholic natural law theory, the Protestants were seeking to establish and seek for a justification of a state without having the imposition of the Catholic Church upon the state. And Hugo Grotius was one of the individuals that contributed the most to this. He expounded upon Protestant natural law theory, and basically, rather than looking at it as a means for man's moral perfection, he actually viewed natural law theory as a means for social peace rather than moral perfection. And thus the political order based upon Protestant natural law theory is that you have God, the individual in direct relation to God, and then the state and the church in a tension between one another, and the individual being a citizen of the state, having obligations there, but also if they choose to be part of a church, well then of course having corresponding obligations from the spiritual level. Natural law theory had been dormant for the last 600 years, and it was during World War II that it came in. There was a revival of natural law theory based on the Nuremberg war trials. When they began to investigate the claims of the Nazi regime, they found that based upon the laws within the state of Germany, they hadn't violated any law because their laws had been based upon a legal theory known as positivism or legal realism. Basically, that means that man is the one who decides what is a law that needs to be passed in society and enforced. without any kind of regard to the transcendental realm, strictly dealing with man formulating these laws. Well, based on the laws that Germany had at the time, they had identified the Jews as a group, inferior group of people that needed to be persecuted. And so therefore they went about this ethnic cleansing. They argued, therefore, that they were innocent based on the laws of Germany. Thank you. The challenge that the war court, at the Nuremberg war trials, that the world court faced was how to reconcile the claims of the law in Germany with the outrage of society around the world for the atrocities that had been done there. And the only conclusion that the court came to is that they had to appeal to a law outside of the legal system within Germany, to a higher law. And that was the beginning of the revival of natural law theory during the 20th century. In addition, a second case that began to revive natural law theory was Martin Luther King Jr. During the civil rights movement in the 1960s. In his letter from a Birmingham jail, he actually appealed to a law that was higher than the laws of the Supreme Court of our land. And that was another emphasis that was placed upon the development of natural law theory in present times. Now, I'm going to deal with four specific objections to natural law theory, and then after that, look at some of the positive contributions of natural law theory. One of the things that typically does come up, at least from a legal perspective, about natural law theory is they say that it is devoid of specific content. And if we're looking at classical natural law theory, that's a valid argument, because classical natural law theory, from the Greek perspective, basically looked at natural law theory as simply as something that was governed the moral nature of man. It was something that led him to appeal to an unjust ruling or unjust situations in life. It had no specific content. Thomas Aquinas was the one who merged classical natural law theory with more of a Christian perspective, and therefore began to give it content. And, of course, the difference between Catholic natural law theory and Protestant natural law theory is in the political realm, which does not allow justification for the Catholic Church to impose its moral theology upon every individual in a specific society or state. A second argument or objection to natural law theory is that if it's based on man's reason and sense of justice, then it will be faulty because man is a sinner. And again, that is a valid argument if we look at it from the classical natural law theory, because that was based from the Greek perspective of philosophy. It did not involve any kind of Christian biblical content. But if we look at natural law theory from a Catholic as well as a Protestant perspective, that argument doesn't have much weight, simply because those two perspectives do recognize that man does have a faulty conscience, a faulty moral nature, and therefore some aspects of natural law theory need to have a biblical or theological parameter to establish it correctly. The third objection is that it originated in Greek philosophy and not Christianity. My response to that is simply that just because the Greeks were the ones to first conceive of it and write about it doesn't mean that they originated it. It's something that when we approach it from a biblical perspective, that it has foundations that go back to the existence of God himself. Even, you know, God doesn't, he always has been, therefore natural law theory has always had some kind of justification for existence in the universe. A fourth objection is that it lacks a substantive definition of legal standards. And again, once an individual takes time to look at the first point in response to that fourth objection, is that actually it is founded in Scripture in Romans chapter 2, verses 14 and 15, where Paul is talking about the differences between the Jews that have the law and those, the Gentiles, that do not have the law. He says that whenever they act upon their conscience, that they are a law to themselves. So there is, again, it's brief. The Bible itself does not speak to natural law theory to great extent, because the Bible itself is special revelation, whereas natural law theory is more along the perspective of general revelation. What is out not only in nature, but also based on the work of God through the Holy Spirit upon the individual mind of man, even though they're not believers. There's some aspect, vestiges, we might say, of the imago Dei, the image of God still in man. So from that perspective, Scripture addresses it, but briefly. The second point that's a benefit of natural law theory is that it provides a bridge between Christians and non-believers regarding moral values And that's the theme that we're looking at, is finding common ground in the public square between conservative Christian groups and those that are liberals that perhaps are not even believers of any type. The third benefit of natural law theory is that it provides a theory of accountability for legal jurisprudence. And this would be one of the points that would actually argue against the position that Nazi Germany had obtained dealing with National Socialism. Point number four, it provides legitimation for a state. By simple definition of the fact that there is a law, natural law, it implies that there is a lawgiver. And therefore, there is a transcendental authority above the state to which the state is accountable. The fifth point, it provides for separation of church and state from a Protestant natural law perspective, not a Catholic law, natural law perspective. Number six, it provides a system of justification for God's judgments of every human being. If there was not some type of law, natural law, that God could use in judging non-believers, it poses theological dilemmas on that point. So natural law actually provides justification for God's judgment of those that are non-believers. Number seven, it provides impetus to gospel preaching because, an important point, the law, whether it's the Decalogue, revealed law, or specific or general law through natural law, law cannot save. Only Christ saves. So it does provide an impetus for gospel preaching because of that aspect. Now, just dealing briefly, natural law in the spirit of prophecy, there were actually 139 hits if you type in the word natural law in her writings in the E.G. White database. This is just one of them that she refers to. Sinful indulgence defiles the body and unfits men for spiritual worship. He who cherishes the light which God has given him upon health reform has an important aid in the work of becoming sanctified through the truth and fitted for immortality. But if he disregards that light and lives in violation of natural law, he must pay the penalty, etc. So she actually associates natural law theory with the well-being, physical well-being, as well as the spiritual well-being of an individual. Now, application of natural law, like I said at the beginning, coming back to this aspect of same-sex marriage, in order to be fair to those individuals in American society that have no religious foundation, they don't believe in God or they're agnostic, in order to be fair to them in the public square, it is not proper for us as Christians to come to them and argue for morality based on the Bible that they don't even believe in. So based on that, from the perspective of equality, to find common ground for dialogue between us and non-believers in the public square, or even those of other religious persuasions, this aspect of natural law theory contributes much. And, for example, in the case of same-sex marriage, several propositions we need to take a moment to look at in response to that. Number one, point A here, both hetero and homosexual marriages cannot be right from a logical perspective. Therefore, if all same-sex couples lived exclusively to themselves, would they continue to exist after three or four generations? No, because there's no procreation that's involved. If they were isolated off in one state in America or off in an island to themselves, after several generations, all of them would die out and there wouldn't be any furtherance of the human race. So from that perspective alone, we can argue from a natural law perspective that such a lifestyle is contrary to law. It's in violation of natural law. Parameters of natural law theory, I've mentioned those previously. Just briefly looking at those, it must have biblical support. Spirit of prophecy emphasizes it combines health and the spiritual. It provides common ground for Christians and unbelievers. It provides state legitimation. It provides for separation of church and state. It avoids positivism or legal realism. It provides a transcendent element to avoid self-justification of nationalism, which is what happened in Nazi Germany. And it must not be associated with Catholic natural law theory. In closing, also the parameters of social justice must involve three points. In seeking social justice or social service, it's part of the ministry of the church, meeting the needs of humanity. Social justice finds support and definition through natural law. And natural law, by virtue of it being law, it cannot save. Thus, for the church, the greater weight of emphasis must be upon preaching the gospel. Thank you.